Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Crime and Science Radio here, first show in 2015, with today's show being called What You Did Here Told Me Who You Are, an interview with criminal behavior expert Mark Saffrick. So now, here's your host of Crime and Science Radio, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome, everyone. You may have seen our guest today on television. He was the host of Killer Instinct, and he's known as an expert on criminal profiling. We're so pleased to have Mark Saffrick with us. Mark is a former FBI supervisory special agent. He has 30 years of work in law enforcement, and 12 of those were in the FBI's elite profiling unit. So Mark's mentor was one of the most famous profilers of all time, considered the founding father of criminal profiling, Robert K. Ressler. And he also worked in Forensic Behavioral Services International with Robert Ressler before he passed away. So and continues that work now on his own. So we're very pleased to have you. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Jen. Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Yeah, welcome, Mark.
So tell us about your background. How did you end up, let's start with just getting into the FBI. How did you become an FBI agent?
Well, I mean, I started my law enforcement career in California at Davis PD. I had actually been working as an EMT on an ambulance as I had graduated from college, and I was waiting to hear from med school, and I became an EMT working on an ambulance, and I ended up going to a lot of shootings and stabbings and assaults, and in that time frame I was working with a lot of police officers and looking at how they did their job, and I became interested because I only saw a piece of it, and I became fascinated by the sort of life that law enforcement was living, and I started going on these law enforcement ride-along programs. I don't know if they still have those, but it allowed citizens to ride with officers to see what they would actually did on a normal shift. And most people just go one time. But I kept going back and back, and I think after about the 12th or 13th time, the sergeant that I was riding with said, Mark, why don't you just become a reserve police officer? You obviously like this work. So that's what I did. I put myself through the Sacramento County Sheriff's Academy, Reserve Police Academy, and I became a reserve police officer. And initially, I started working as a two-man unit, as the second officer in a two-man unit. I did that for about 6 months, and then was allowed to take a unit by myself. So I was doing everything an officer was doing. I just wasn't being paid. So I had a regular job, and then at night I would go and do this work. And I started to realize that I really liked law enforcement work. And it wasn't that I didn't like medicine. I did. But I felt sort of this calling towards law enforcement. And that's where it all started. And I ended up becoming a regular police officer. I ended up applying and becoming a regular police officer, going to the police academy, and then becoming a patrol officer. I was a patrol officer for about 3.5 years. But there was this part of me that when I would take a report, an assault or a burglary or, a stabbing case, where I would take the initial report, but I'd always have to pass it off to detectives. And after a while, I'm like, I want to follow up on these cases. I want to see, I want to do the investigation. So I applied to become a detective, and I had an advantage because back then in the in the late 70s, unlike now, a lot of police officers could be in law enforcement with a high school education. But I had a college education. I had my degree in physiology. So I could write well. I mean, I wrote reports well, and I ended up promoting into detectives. And I absolutely loved it. And I started off in property crimes, and then I moved into violent crimes. And I mean, I was working homicides and rapes and ADWs or assaults with deadly weapons. And I just loved the investigative aspect, the challenge of putting together a case, you know, that you're bringing, trying to bring into court, but you're trying to put all the physical evidence together and the witness interviews together. And when I was assigned to be in violent crimes, I went to a homicide school, a two-week homicide school in Marysville. And at that school, this was, I think, 1982, at that school, there were two FBI profilers who came out to give us a couple of days of this, how you look at violent crimes, rapes, murders, from a behavioral perspective. And you have to remember, this was 1982, and profiling was really, it wasn't in its infancy, but it was in the really early stages. So after that 2 days, I was absolutely mesmerized by this different way of looking at violent crime. And I was working a couple of homicide cases. I had a double homicide and a single homicide, and both of them had very unusual aspects to them that I thought might benefit from being assessed by the FBI's, at that time, it was the Behavioral Sciences Unit at the FBI Academy. So I thought those cases would, because they were unsolved, they were cold cases, that they would benefit from a review by the FBI. And that really is what started my journey. I contacted the Sacramento FBI office. I started interacting with them, indicating that I'd like to send my cases back to the FBI for review by the unit. I ended up talking to agents back at the FBI Academy, which is where I first talked to Robert Ressler. So my introduction to the FBI, besides being a detective, the first real work that I did with them was my cases that I had submitted for review by them. And, you know, to jump ahead a little bit, I just want to say I was the only FBI profiler to have been a detective, submitted cases as a detective to the unit, and then once I was a profiler, I think I'd been in the unit about 5 years, actually pulled those cases out that I had submitted, and I went through them. And here in the opening communications were letters from me as a detective to the unit asking for assistance. And here I was now, many, many years later, as a profiler with at least 5 years experience in the unit, now assessing my own cases that I had submitted. So it was that full circle for me. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm the only person that had been in the unit where that had come to fruition. So it was a very rewarding kind of journey to be able to look at my own cases when I could never have done that as a detective. I simply didn't have the knowledge or the tools or the understanding to do that. But it was my introduction, and I became so interested in this work, this discipline, that I made the decision that this is what I really wanted to do in law enforcement, was to become an FBI profiler. And I made the decision then to apply to the FBI with the eventual goal. And of course, not everybody ever, you know, makes that, even if they desire to do that. But that's why I came into the Bureau, was to do that kind of work. Well, and it took me 11 years. Once I got, you know, accepted, you know, it was a very long process because it was a very competitive process. Once I was accepted, it took me 11 years after I got out into the field before they actually had openings for the unit that I applied to. So it was a great great honor to be selected. And then, of course, that's where I wanted to be in the FBI. And I spent over half of my 23-year career in the FBI, in the FBI's behavioral analysis unit, and loved every day that I went to work. It was a very challenging and tremendously rewarding.
You kind of answered the question that was in my head, and what we're going to ask is how you went from point A to point B. But you said it took you 11 years to get from point A to point B once you had entered the door of the FBI. What kind of things did you do during that 11-year period while you were waiting for the gig you really wanted?
Right. So that's a question I get all the time. Like, how do I become an FBI profiler? And most people think that, well, if you apply to the FBI and you get into the FBI, then you can say, well, I want to be a profiler. I want to get into the profiling unit. But it doesn't work that way, of course. First of all, it's very competitive just getting into the FBI. But once you're in, you are a special agent. And the Bureau will assign you to some field office. In my case, because of my violent crime background as an investigator, I was initially assigned to the Denver Division. And I was supposed to be in Denver, but I got a call from the assistant agent in charge of the Denver office. And, of course, I was still in the academy at the time, right? I was just a total newbie, right? And he said, hey, Mark, we're going to send you to work the Indian Reservation in Riverton, Wyoming. And he says, you don't have any problems with that, do you? And I'm like, well, what am I supposed to say? I'm talking to the head of the Denver FBI Field Division, right? And I'm just a guy in the academy. I'm like, well, I guess not. No, I don't have any problems with that. So that was my first assignment. I spent most of my life in California. I didn't really even know where Wyoming was. I knew it was sort of in the middle of the country someplace, right? So, I'm like, okay. And I ended up, being in a small town, working all the violent crimes on the reservation for 3.5 years. It was very difficult work, and it was just a two-man office. We were out of the Denver office, but I was almost 400 miles from my field division, and I covered the entire, with my partner, the entire northwest corner of Wyoming, and we had Jackson Hole on the west. Which my partner took that road trip to Jackson Hole, and then I covered the reservation and then up to Cody, Wyoming. So we had a huge territory, and we covered all of the federal crimes, but most of my work was on the reservation. So that's where I spent my first 3.5 years. And then I was transferred to the New York field office, and I mostly worked undercover in New York my entire career there. I did work as a coordinator for the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime, which is what the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit falls under. So I was assisting with training in New York. I was doing homicide training, major crime scene management, teaching at police academies. Throughout the New York's FBI Field Division, West Point Military Academy, Sheriff's Academies. So I enjoyed that very much, but I most of my work was working undercover, and I was in the New York field office for 5.5 years, and then I took a transfer to the Sacramento Field Division for the Stockton Resident Agency, where, again, I ended up working mostly violent crimes, and became the NCAVC coordinator, or National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime coordinator, in Sacramento. And the Sacramento field office actually covers about 2/3 of the state of California. So we had a really huge territory, and I had the great privilege of working with Mike Prodan from the California Department of Justice, who was the California profiler, and I learned a tremendous amount from him. And it really, hardened my resolve to be in the unit. I just still love the work. And, of course, being a coordinator was a real advantage when you applied to become a profiler in the unit, because the process was very competitive and the unit's very small. I think most people, when you look at an FBI field office, you have the same types of work groups in each field office working violent crime and white-collar crime and cyber crime and terrorism. But the profilers are all centrally located at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. So it's a very small cadre of individuals. In my unit, we only had 8 agents working the adult crimes for the entire United States, and we did a tremendous amount of work internationally. So our resources were spread very thin. So competition to get into that unit was keen. And it is a promotional position, so you go from special agent to supervisory special agent. So it's not a process that you can, it's not a lateral transfer, so you have to apply and compete for it. And that's what takes a lot of time. You have to prove yourself in the FBI as a competent investigative agent, very analytical thinker, a good work record, you know, where your cases are resolved well, write good paper. I mean, you just have to be really a good agent to be considered. And then you have to have the background for it, right? So you're, because you're competing against other people who are also equally qualified. So every advantage that you can take is helpful. And having been an NCABC coordinator, both in Sacramento and in my last couple years in New York, was very helpful. So that's why it took me so long. And it's a very long process. And when I talk to students in high school and in college, I tell them, well, you know, by the time I became a profiler, I was about 40 years old, you know. And for them, it's just an eternity because, like, well, I want to be a profiler. I want to get out of college and join the FBI. And I said, well, first of all, the average age of agents getting into the FBI is about 29 to 30 years of age. Even though you can get in at 23, almost nobody does because it's so competitive. You have to have some type of executive type work experience, managerial work experience, because you're just competing with so many other people that do. And then you're going to have to prove yourself in the bureau. So by the time, you know, that's going to take you 8 to 10 years. So by the time you're really in a position to be competitive for being in the behavioral analysis unit, you really are in your late 30s or maybe even early 40s. So for them, it's an eternity. When you're talking to a 20-year-old, you know, it's just like, oh my God, maybe I won't do that.
So for that whole specialty, though, hasn't been around all that long, right? How did criminal profiling begin?
Well, it really, you know, I think there, law enforcement agencies have done it in one way or another. I mean, Sherlock Holmes was doing it. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was writing about it. You know, this sort of analytical logic in thinking, you know, integrating behavior with forensics and physical evidence, you know, making logical deductions. I mean, we've been doing that in law enforcement, but the process really became accelerated in the FBI because the FBI hosts the National Academy 4 times a year. So the FBI brings in sergeants, lieutenants, captains, chiefs of police from around the country and around the world 4 times a year, about 225 highly qualified law enforcement personnel. And they spend about 11 weeks at the academy. Well, a lot of those individuals are investigators, and at the time they were bringing cases with them, unsolved cases, very unusual cases, serial murder cases, sexual homicide cases, that were either unsolved or very confounding or just very, very interesting because of what was going on in the crime. And then they were asking the behavioral sciences unit for, you know, can you help us look at this case? And the problem was at the time in the early 70s, you know, we didn't really have any, we hadn't done any research in this area. So we were trying to assist these agencies, you know, all year long, different agencies with their questions. And we realized, you know, if we're going to try to answer questions about mass murderers or sexual murderers or serial murderers, we really ought to do some work in this area. We ought to talk to these guys that have committed these crimes. We ought to look at their crimes and try to understand that. And that really was the genesis of the unit. Like, how... where do we start? Let's do some research. Let's talk to some of these offenders. Let's try to understand why they made the decisions that they made. What were they looking at? What were they thinking about? Were they conscious of evidence? What types of victims were they selecting and why? Because in order to assist the law enforcement agencies with their complex cases, we really had to get on the ball and start doing research of our own. And that's where that initial research began. That's where they started going out and interviewing serial rapists and serial killers and mass murderers to really understand that mindset. And I think it was the agencies asking for help was really what put the onus on the FBI to begin this research. And when it became fairly well established, we invited 36 investigators from around the world, different countries, different agencies, a number of them from the United States, Canada, Germany, Australia, to come to the FBI and live here for a year and train with us. And then they would go back to their agencies and they would start their own units. And that was really the core beginning of what is now the International Criminal Investigative Analysis Fellowship. And the FBI supported that. You know, they brought these investigators in for, I think it was 11 months. They lived at the FBI Academy. They worked alongside the profilers. They looked at these cases. And they were getting all the training that the agents were getting, and then they took that experience and training and education back to their agencies and started their own assessment units. So these agencies now have many of them have very sophisticated and strong units.
Now,
when
you guys approach a crime scene, particularly a violent crime scene where some murder has taken place. You know, the police and investigators are always looking for evidence and, you know, DNA and footprints and fingerprints and yada, yada, yada. But one of the things, obviously, that the perpetrator leaves behind is a little evidence of his own psyche. But there's a lot of myths and misconceptions about what profilers do. You know, everything from they conjure up images and, you know, they use voodoo and a hologram of the guy appears and you watch television and you think you guys are magicians. But the question is what can you and can you not do and how do you really aid the investigation?
Well, that's a great question because I think, you know, television seems to give us a misperception of what we really can do. You know, we were never in a position to say, okay, so your killer is this guy right here, and, you know, right. John Jones, and this is where he lives. That's not what we're doing. What we're really doing is helping to focus an investigation. You know, typically when we get asked for assistance in a case, it's because they don't have an offender. Their offender is unknown, and they have literally run out of, you know, all the leads. They've done all the investigative work. And they're looking for, you know, some fresh eyes look at this case, but from a different perspective. And not all crimes are really amenable to being behaviorally assessed because, and in fact, when I lecture, I talk about this, that, you know, we on average, we have between 14 and 15,000 murders in the United States a year. But very few of those cases really are good cases for being behaviorally assessed, because there simply is not enough dynamic interaction between the victim and the offender. So many cases just simply don't qualify, you know, gang killings, drug killings, a lot of domestic homicide cases where there's a history. The law enforcement doesn't need our assistance in those types of cases. They have the experience and knowledge to do the a case like that. And they may have a strong history of violence between particular individuals. A lot of times the case is simply a smoking gun. You have a knife fight in a bar. You have a lot of witnesses. And so those cases are readily solved. It's when the cases become more complex. You have multiple victims, multiple offenders, and a crime scene that a lot of detectives have not seen before.
Well, let's pick up more on this when we get back after our break.
Take your manuscript to the next level with Yeah Sure Editorial Services. Writing, editing, proofreading, and more. Visit www.yeahshoreeditorial.com. Publisher Midnight Inc. brings fans the very best mystery books. Resurrection Bay by Wayne McDaniel and Steve Womack. Terminated by Ray Daniel. Trapline by Mark Stevens are just a few of the great books available now. Check out www.midnightinkbooks.com for more information on this and many more titles. Waters of Oblivion is the third book in David Lyon's Jock Boucher thriller series. The series started with Ice Fire and then Blood Game. Check out davidlyonsauthor.com for more information on all the books in the series. Two mothers, two sons, a trail is going cold. The Missing Place is the latest book from author Sophie Littlefield. A satisfying, icy thriller is what Kirkus Review says. Check out simonandschuster.com for more information on this and all of their great books. If your family is a target, you have to be a weapon. Bloodline by John Davis is a high-octane thrill ride. And the latest in the Granger Spy novel series. When you can't trust anyone else, trust your family. Visit johnjdavis.com for more information. Suspense Magazine is giving readers the deal of a lifetime, and we do mean lifetime, because right now, anybody that orders a subscription to Suspense Magazine will get that subscription automatically flipped into a lifetime one. That means only $24 will ensure that you receive Suspense Magazine forever. So go to suspensemagazine.com and click on Order the Magazine and get your lifetime subscription today.
All it takes is the perfect shot. You can take your shot this year in New York City during the 10-year anniversary of Thriller Fest. Take aim during Craft Fest, Pitch Fest, Thriller Fest, and new this year, Career Fest, all designed to help you hit your mark. Meet the pros, like 2015 Thriller Master Nelson DeMille, Silver Bullet recipient Kathy Reichs, with spotlight guests Greg Isles, Charlene Harris, and Mark Billingham. And let the best help you zero in on your career target at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, July 7th through the 11th, 2015. It's time. Take your shot. Register now. www.thrillerfest.com.
Join Stephen King, Peter Straub, Ellen Datlow, Ramsey Campbell, Jonathan Mayberry, and hundreds more in the Horror Writers Association's campaign, HorrorSelfies.com. Take a selfie with any written message promoting reading or with your favorite book. Check in at HorrorSelfies.com to submit your photo, and you can win signed books. Help us let the world know why horror is important and submit your selfie today. That's www.horrorselfies.com.
On Crime and Science Radio again with special guest Mark Safrick. Again, today's show is called What You Did Here Told Me Who You Are. So now, again, here are your hosts of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, over the break we were just saying how we wish we had about three shows here that we could get into everything we want to get into with Mark. But so understanding that we can just touch on a few basics here, can you give us an idea of how a criminal profiler approaches a case?
Sure. So I think the initial perception of people is that we're profiling people. Like when I meet somebody and they find out what I do, they say, "Well, are you profiling me?" And I say, "No, I'm not." You know, the process is in a sense rather boring because it's a micro analysis of a crime and the crime scene dynamics. What we're really trying to do is to incorporate the behavior and interaction of an offender and the victim and the crime scene together and integrate that with what we know about the forensic evidence and the physical evidence so that we create a scenario, we create the story of the crime, we can recreate it, we understand the flow of the crime to understand essentially what happened, how it happened, and critically why it happened. So as I said before, most violent crimes really are not amenable to being behaviorally assessed. You need a really complex, unusually violent, with a lot of interaction between the offender and the victim, or multiple offenders or multiple victims. And it's those types of cases that oftentimes law enforcement gets, they don't have a lot of experience with those, and we do. So what I really need is all of the initial case information. I need the initial crime reports, initial crime scene photographs, the evidence that was collected and if any of it was tested, autopsy photographs and reports, aerial photographs, interviews of initial witnesses, because all of that initial information becomes very important to understand really what is going on at the crime scene. Once I understand that, once I understand the flow of the crime and I understand those crime scene dynamics, then I'm starting to look at areas like motive. What is the motive for the crime? What is the level of planning and organization this offender engaged in? How did he choose this particular individual for assault or for murder? How did he get into the scene and how did he get out of the scene? What decision-making process did he engage in? What did he do with the body? How did he commit the homicide? What were the weapons? What was the level of injury? And injury became a very important piece for me because I ended up doing a lot of research on injury severity and how, why some offenders engage in a tremendous amount of injury and others do not. And it ended up becoming somewhat predictive in my research. But there's a lot of these different dynamic attributes to the crime. I'm trying to understand those, doing an analysis and then ultimately interpreting all this information. When I do that, then that helps me to understand what type of offender I'm looking for. So ultimately, the goal is to take that behavioral information, the forensic evidence, the physical evidence, in its totality. And then from that, that helps me to understand what type of an offender I'm looking for, perhaps demographic characteristics, personality characteristics, behavioral characteristics, how this individual will interact with people around him, friends, family, coworkers, what type of life he'll have, where he'll live in relationship to the crime scene. So it's done really to help focus an investigation and point officers, investigators in the right direction, or to refine that direction, or to actually take them in a completely different direction from where they're going. So ultimately, it's really focused on the offender, but not like it's this person, but really this is the type of individual we're looking for. This is the relationship the offender has with this victim based on this dynamic. And sometimes I'm always looking at their MO, their modus operandi. What is it they're doing to be successful in committing the crime, to protect their identity, to help them get away? And then I'm also considering, what is their ritual behavior? What is their need-driven behavior that actually elevates their risk for committing the crime? What do they do that doesn't actually have anything to do with being successful in either committing the murder or committing the sexual assault? And then there are other behavioral dynamics I'm considering. Is there staging going on at this crime scene? And if there is, what does that mean? Is there depersonalization of these victims? Is there undoing behavior going on at this crime scene? And what does that mean? And in my show, Killer Instinct, there were all cases in which I had a major role in helping to, get the case resolved, or I testified as an expert in those cases. When in all those episodes, I'm talking about these different behavioral dynamics. So to let the audience understand what it is I really am seeing in this complex scene and how it impacts the investigation. But honestly, the detectives in all those cases really are the heroes. Those are the guys with the boots on the ground who are doing all the work. And I come in for a very specific type of work on the case, on certain specific types of cases where this type of an analysis can be beneficial.
Well, I think one of the things that I think Michael Connelly once famously said, that it's not the effect of the cop on the crime, but the crime on the cop, that's an important story. And you mentioned earlier how early on in this field, as it was growing and expanding, that you realized you didn't know anything, and you better go do some research and talk to some of these people. So when you go in and sit down and you're literally face-to-face to some of the most disturbed people on this planet, how does that affect you? How do you cope with that? What's the dynamic there? How do you not get dirty in your head?
Well, I mean, I think that really is, it's a great question, because I think it's one of the hallmarks of a really good criminal profiler is that ability to emotionally dissociate yourself from the level of human depravity that you deal with every single day. You have to, I think it's one of the things that has made me successful and other profilers is that I try to be very objective when I look at these cases. I don't have a relationship with these victims or the offenders or their families or the witnesses like the police officers do. And I've seen these types of really egregious human brutality over and over again in photographs, in videotapes the offenders make. So I can dissociate myself from it and not allow myself to become emotionally involved. And it's the same when doing interviews with these offenders. I'm really, my job is to understand, the decisions that they make and not really to be passing judgment, especially in front of them. When I'm working these cases, they are often cold cases, and I see myself as being in a position of last resort, because the police have worked these cases already. They're looking for something else, another spark, a different direction, something that they didn't see before. If I allow myself to be consumed and sucked into this tremendous depravity that you see and become affected by it, then I can't become effective. I don't become effective. And really, I'm trying to stand in both the victim's shoes and the offender's shoes to understand what this dynamic is. And if I can't do it objectively, then I can't do my job, and I can't help out. I can't help these victims or their families get any kind of justice if I'm not in a position to do my job. And some people can't. That's a big question I get. How can you look at this every single day? How can you talk to people like that without wanting to, you know, just jump over the table? But, you know, I'm really think that it's important to maintain that objectivity. And I'm much more fascinated when I interview these individuals about the decisions they make. I can be disgusted by what they've done later on, but when I'm talking to them, you know, I try to, in a sense, sort of normalize that behavior so that, you know, I don't want to shut them down, and it's easy to do, and I've seen it happen in many, many interviews in the past. And again, you know, it depends on your offender too. Some will readily talk to you, and others will talk to you if you know how to make the approach. And it's, you know, those are all learning experiences, and understanding the type of individual you're dealing with. But I'm very comfortable maintaining that distance between what I do in my personal life and what I do in my business life. Even though I may think about these cases, and often do when I'm not working, I don't allow that to come in and cloud my judgment, or, you know, suck me in emotionally into the cases. Then I'm not helping anybody, not the law enforcement officers, and certainly not the victims.
You would have probably made a very good physician, because in many respects, that's exactly what we have to do on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. I think it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, very, very similar. Good answer.
Well, yeah. Among other areas of expertise, I know you help out people and have a lot of different types of crimes going on, but you are known for your work in an area I think that there's not a lot of public understanding about, and that's cases concerning those who sexually assault and murder elderly women. And your findings sort of countered some previously held assumptions. So I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about your research in that area and your work in that area.
Sure. I mean, really, I think my overall broad area of expertise is in homicide, and specifically in sexual homicide. And when I first came into the unit, I was assigned some cases out of Colorado Springs. It was a couple of elderly women, one in her 80s and one in her 90s, who had been brutally murdered. And one of the first things I wanted to try to understand was what type of individual who can readily control a woman like this because of her age. Why does someone like this inflicting so much injury? And I went to the research literature to see if there had been anything that had been written about this or studied about this, and I found that there really was absolutely nothing out there. There had been some research by some well-known researchers, Nathan Pollack and Nick Roth, looking at sexual assault of elderly females, but they didn't differentiate between those who had been murdered and those who hadn't. And I was specifically interested in these elder women over the age of 65, who had been sexually assaulted and murdered by the offenders. And that really started me off. I started the research in 1996, and I was and I'm still doing that research and still publishing articles in this area, and I would just say it's more of a subspecialty area of mine of sexual homicide, and I think it's been very helpful because there really was no specific research in this area, and you know, working these types of cases before the research was done, we had ideas about, well, it seems like this might be a younger type offender who is the more violent ones are the youngest. But we had no empirical data to support that. And so, you know, the first research articles that I published, you know, we started to see correlations between what we were actually saying from our experience and what we were learning from the research data. So that is incredibly important, because sometimes, like, I'll give you, for instance, I've been doing research on this particular area about women who are strangled manually, elderly females who are strangled manually, and do they have neck structure injury damage? And actually, it's more of a medical article that I'm writing than a profiling article. But one thing that really was surprising was that intuitively we would think that when you strangle, especially an elder woman, the neck structures are very frangible and easily broken, the hyoid bone and the thyroid cartilage. But actually, it was really amazing to see that about 25% of these women who are strangled have no neck structure injury at all, which I found absolutely astounding. So here you have empirical research data that flies in the face of what you would actually think would happen just from your experience. And I think that's the value of research. It either proves or disproves what you know from your experiential work in these types of cases.
Well, so if you have that kind of data, then can you just give us an example of how, say, if you have a case, the impact that knowledge might have on looking at a case?
Sure. I mean, I remember getting a call from Oakland County Sheriff's outside of Detroit, and I ended up publishing an article with this investigator. And just on the phone, he was running down this case of this elder 97-year-old woman. She was just getting ready to turn 98, who had been raped and murdered and stabbed multiple times in her residence. And he told me, he said, you know, I have been working homicides for many years. I've worked over 400 homicide cases, and I had never seen a homicide case like this before. And honestly, I had no idea who we were looking for, what kind of guy would do this kind of thing. And from my research, him talking to me, and I'm asking him specific questions about neighborhood demographics and her injuries, and I said, the guy you're looking for is going to look like this. And I laid out the sort of the parameters, and he goes, you know, I've got a guy, and, you know, they had like 25 suspects. I said, I got a guy in my list of suspects who matches all those criteria, and it turned out to be the guy. So here was a perfect example of the research actually focusing down to one particular individual that ended up being the offender in this murder case.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's and when I lecture about this around the country, I tell you that every time I give this lecture, and I'm going to be presenting this next March for the St. Louis Major Crimes Task Force, a very well-respected task force group. I always get detectives coming up to me going, you know, I've got a case just like that, and the offender that I have is exactly like you described. And it really is amazing, because here we now have the research empirical data to support what we're looking at in terms of these types of these incredibly violent offenders, and, you know, why what we are looking at in the crime scene that tells us about, you know, the decisions we make about the type of guy we should be looking for. It's been very helpful.
Yeah. Well, before we run out of time here, you know, Janet mentioned earlier that you wanted to talk a little bit about, and we want you to talk a little bit about your television shows. Why don't you tell us something about what you're doing, what you've got going? I mean, I've watched the other one you had on that ran, the series that ran, outstanding, just outstanding.
Thanks.
I videoed all of them and watched them over and over again. But what's going on now?
Yeah, that show, Killer Instinct, that's on iTunes under TV Nonfiction.
Yeah,
but I just finished filming a cold case homicide series in Sweden that will be getting airing in Sweden in either late February or early March. And I was working with a really great inspector from the Swedish National Police. And I think we're strongly looking for a season two to start filming in May. And then as a result of that, I was contacted by a production company in Denmark, and they want to do the same show. So now we're in the process of putting that show together, and I begin filming that cold case homicide show in January. I leave tomorrow for Japan, where I'm filming for a week on a mass murder case that has essentially stumped the authorities there and is unsolved. And I'm going to see if I can perhaps lend a different perspective on this. So I'll be there for a week filming. I've done a number of shows. I did a show that aired this last summer for a History Channel. And I guess I really enjoy television work, and I think what I really like about it is explaining to the audience really this whole dynamic of what it is we're doing. In a sense, demystifying, I think, what some of the shows like Criminal Minds and others, and I do consulting work for CSI Las Vegas and for Bones, and I just started doing some for The Blacklist. Those shows, you're trying to entertain people while you're also trying to present the accurate side of the science, but you're trying to do it in a very short time frame. What I'm really doing is taking these complex cases and sort of dissecting them and saying, okay, here's when you look at a triple murder case, you know, you can't be overwhelmed by the violence that you see. Let's take this apart and start to understand, what do we have in the victimology? What do we have in the injuries? What do we have in how they got in or got out? What's the motive here? And take it apart and start to explain these pieces, what each of them mean and how they impact how you assess that dynamic between the offender and the victim. Did they have a relationship? What kind of relationship was that? Was this really a pure stranger case? And what things in there become important to assess, and what things are more artifact? And I think the audience appreciates really understanding the process of how I look at something. And that's what interests them, the reality of what we're really trying to do here.
That's what interested me.
Yeah.
Are there things that we've learned about what makes people violent that we could be applying to prevent that kind of violence?
It's a great question, and you know, it's a question that we have asked in academia, in law enforcement for a long time, in the medical field. You know, why are people violent? What makes a serial killer? And I think the answer, and I think, you know, we're not there yet, but we have learned that it is a combination of nurture and nature. There is a genetic biological component that plays a role. Then there is the environment, how an individual is raised. Did they have an absentee father or mother? Were they alcoholics? Were they sexually abused, emotionally abused, physically abused? Those two together interact in a way that creates the personality of an individual. And not only that, but when they experience certain stressors or certain impacts in their life, it impacts them greater at a certain age and less at another age. And we're beginning to understand those dynamics of the sort of the biology of violence. You know, what components really make an impact? What creates psychopaths, and how do we understand that? Is it really, is it how the brain forms, or is it also, how they're raised and how they see the world, and how do those two mesh together? We're getting closer. There's a tremendous amount of research in this area. Bob Hare is doing research on psychopaths mm-hmm. in the brain, and others are writing areas, looking at actually the you know, the biology of violence, and other psychiatrists and psychologists are examining these points. And it's a component that we addressed in 2005 in our serial murder symposium that the FBI hosted in 2005 in San Antonio, Texas, looking at the etiology of these really disturbing serial killers, mass murderers. You know, what is it? Why are they different than you and I? What is it about them? Is it in their genes? Is it in their biology? Or is it in, you know, how they were raised, their nurturing, upbringing? And I think the answer is it's a combination of both. But we're not there to really be in a position to say, okay, if we do this, we can stop it. We're not there.
Well, one of the most chilling things I ever heard along this same line, Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, when he finally confessed to all his murders after they got his DNA, but he finally confessed to all these murders, 40-something, 48, 49, whatever. The lead investigator asked him, said, Gary, I don't get it. You know, what do you have that I don't have, and what are you missing that all the rest of us have? And Gary said, I guess it's that caring thing.
Has
that been your experience, that the lack of empathy with victims and with society and with whatever, is that pretty much universal in these types of people?
I think it's I think that probably is too broad of a statement to make. I think we do see a lot of psychopaths, and I mean Gary Ridgway is clearly a psychopath. I think we do see a lot of psychopathy in serial offenders. It would be one of the things that makes them successful. Yeah, you and I, you know, who right. have tremendous empathy for individuals, you would be really affected by killing somebody in really a brutal way. We'd be remorseful. It would affect us, affect our personalities. But psychopaths, you know, they can engage in this egregious behavior and then act as if nothing has happened. I mean, they can be completely unaffected, have absolutely zero empathy for their victims, because the victims for them were just objects that they wanted to use. So, the statement by Gary, him making that statement is absolutely true.
They're playing a role in the script.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of really violent offenders, being a psychopath, they probably, of course, it's a scale, they probably will score much higher than the average person in psychopathic traits.
Sure.
But I think it's very high in serial offenders, and it's really, unfortunately, one of the aspects that makes them so successful.
Well, Mark, this has been so fascinating. Thank you so much. I know you're
absolutely
jammed up, getting ready to leave for Japan tomorrow.
No, I know. Yeah, I had early
tomorrow
morning.
Thank you for taking time out of your really busy schedule to let us hear from you and share so much about your work. Thank you.
Travel
you're
safely,
welcome.
And thanks so much.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks, Jan. Appreciate it.